This is WHFR, Dearborn.
Disclaimer: this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students.
Author Kim Stanley Robinson takes us to the year 2312, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome to the travel show that takes you to the final frontier, and this time, 300 years into humanity's future. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society. In his new novel, 2312, Kim Stanley Robinson shares his vision of a brave new solar system that is chock full of humanity. He'll tell us about it in a special extended podcast conversation. Bill Nye is back to share congratulations for SpaceX, with its Falcon 9 and Dragon capsule now a full-fledged transportation system. And Bruce Betts will tell us about the sky wonders still in store over the next couple of weeks. We'll start with Planetary Society blogger Emily Lakdawalla. Emily, welcome back. Looking over the blog, it sure is nice to see this in the brand new website. It is especially good for multimedia. Good place to watch this video that you collected from a student all about Saturn.
Yeah, that's right. Not only did I collect it from a student, but I only heard about it because somebody told me about it on Twitter. So there's a lot of social media going on here. It's a lovely video. It uses a device that I have to admit I use an awful lot, which is basically just gathering a lot of Cassini's images from many sequences and just running them together in an animation. It's kind of like a digital flipbook. But this one is an especially nice job, and he put the Moonlight Sonata to it, and then the way that the video moves and changes, it just really in rhythm with the music, and it's quite impressive, and you just can't help but watch it all the way through to the end.
Yeah, I especially like the interpretation of the music. One of your commenters said the rough and aggressive interpretation of the Moonlight Sonata. It really works. It's quite lovely to watch. What's interesting about this is that, yes, you've got your blog entries, but we seem to have a real growth spurt. Lots of other guest bloggers joining in at planetary.org.
Yeah, that's something that the new website has really allowed me to do. With the old one, it was hard to feature too many guest bloggers without losing me in the whole shuffle. But this way, the way that we've managed to actually really feature all the different kinds of authors that we have, it's just really brought forward all of the different voices that there are out there, and just kind of shows how many different people are excited about telling people about what's going on in space exploration right now, and are just want to share their stories personally rather than me taking more of a formal role as a reporter, asking them questions and then reporting what they say. It's really amazing how well people can tell their stories in their own voices, and I'm kind of sitting back and letting a lot of people do that right now. Of course, I've got a bit of an editorial role in picking the people who tell their stories, and I'll continue to do that. And of course, I'll also continue to write my own blog entries.
And that editorial role is a very important one. I look forward to joining in more than I have. Very little up there so far, but I think I'm going to be learning how to do this better. So there'll be some more stuff behind my name on that drop-down menu when you go to blogs at planetary.org. I think we're done, Emily. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Matt.
She is the Science and Technology Coordinator for the Planetary Society. Emily Lakdawalla is also a contributing editor to Sky and Telescope magazine. Up next is Bill Nye, the CEO of the Planetary Society. Bill, I see you via Skype in your hotel room in New York, but I know that you were doing what millions of people around the world were doing a few minutes ago.
That's right. SpaceX got its Dragon capsule captured by the robotic arm on the International Space Station.
Woohoo!
Woohoo, indeed. This is a commercial company. I mean, albeit one run by a multi-billionaire, but the guy built his own, they built their own rocket. Got all the specs, all the specifications lined up with NASA. They go up there and they hook up. It everything worked after, albeit, years of preparation. It's fantastic.
Absolutely wonderful. Are you going to mention this in your commencement address in a few minutes?
Oh, yes, yes. I'll be at Rochester Institute of Technology, RIT, one of my old rivals when I went to school in New York State. Just remind the students graduating, this is historic. This is where space exploration is taking a new step. In other words, it's not just the business of governments. Now it's the business of businesses. And this will free up government money to do the next amazing stages of exploration, sending humans out farther into deep space and then ultimately to Mars. It's a big deal.
It certainly is. I guess I should let you get back to preparing that commencement address, although you did just show me your script there, your speech.
This is something I very much look forward to. I really enjoy commencement, being asked to be commencement speaker and speaking, because you really feel like you have this chance to touch the future.
As you speak, I am watching the Earth roll by underneath the Dragon capsule and the International Space Station. It's a good time.
It's an exciting time. So everybody just take notice of this. This is where the United States, again, has somehow developed this entrepreneur who became so wealthy that he can try this out. And of course, he believes it will lead to even greater wealth, as he provides launch services to people around, to organizations around the world that need to get into orbit. It's an exciting time.
Certainly is. Congratulations to SpaceX and especially to Elon. And Bill, to you, break a leg. Go get him.
Thank you, Matt. I got to fly. Bill Nye, the planetary guy.
He is the CEO of the Planetary Society. Just moments away now from a conversation with one of my favorite authors, Kim Stanley Robinson. If all you've read of Kim Stanley Robinson's work is his terrific Mars trilogy, you've missed several books that have kept him one of my favorite authors. The latest is 2312, a spectacular vision of humanity's future that is solidly rooted in today's best available science. It is an exciting mystery and conspiracy tale that is literally as wide as our solar system. Even if you read 2312 just for its incredibly rich descriptions of other worlds, you'd be getting your money's worth, but it offers much more. Robinson, who goes by Stan, stopped by the Planetary Society last week for a book signing. I sat down with him for this special extended conversation that includes discussion of several of his other recent novels. Stan, it is great to have you back. It is always a pleasure to talk to you, and an even greater pleasure, I hope you don't mind me saying this, to read your books.
Well, I don't mind at all. I'm really here to write books. That's why I'm here.
And you've written a whopper, a blockbuster, and I have to admit up front, as I've told you, I'm only about a third of the way into it, because that's all the time I've had, but I am already captivated. Now I see in hardcover for the first time, sitting on the table between us, and it is a marvelous speculation, looking forward 300 years. It is particularly thrilling to me to see this vision you have built of a solar system that is chock full of humanity in just about every space that we can occupy.
Well, that's right. That was the point of this book. I wanted to go out a good long distance, and for me, 300 years is really a long ways off. Hard to imagine, but I postulated that we pulled our powers together, and even though Earth is rather damaged in this story, high sea levels, environmental problems, population problems. Nevertheless, people have gotten out into space. Good space elevators are ringing the Earth's equator, which really is the enabling device to get us out of our gravity well, and then some self-replicating factories and robots to multiply our powers out there. And then all of the literature on terraforming is pretty extensive, and it's very speculative, but what I did was assume that anything that had ever been proposed is likely to get tried, and ran the terraforming quickly plans that come mostly out of the British Interplanetary Society, people like Paul Birch and Martin Fogg and some other theorists, and I applied all of those. And so 300 years is actually enough time to do some remarkable transformations if we could pull together the engineering and the sheer power that would be required. But I've postulated a very robust technological future, and it was a lot of fun.
So at this time, Mars is sort of old news. It's been taken care of.
Yeah.
But you've got folks terraforming Venus, and there is a city on Mercury, which you got to describe. Terminator plays a key part in the story, which I won't give away.
Well, Terminator is actually an old idea of mine. It comes from one of my first novels, Memory of Whiteness, and I've recycled it a couple times. It appeared at the end of the Mars trilogy. The idea that Mercury is actually rotating very, very slowly, so slowly that if you put a city on on tracks, a city about the size of Venice, and about 20 or 30 very thick, powerful, strong tracks of merely stainless steel, really, is strong enough to withstand the heat of the mercurial day, which surprised me, but my friends at NASA Ames assured me that it was true. So the city rolls around in the Terminator at about 5 miles an hour or 3 miles an hour, because it's not right on the equator. It's always being pushed by sunlight, which simply expands the track slightly, and the city is sleeved on the tracks, and it just moves forward. So it always gets a tiny touch of the coming dawn, but of course it couldn't be exposed, and it just is always in that zone of the coming dawn, basically.
It is a great vision of this city, because it's not just, you're not just presenting the concept. I mean, you really get a feel for the people who might someday live in a place like this, and how this place is put together. In fact, your central character, at least she's appears to be the central character at my point in the book, is this fascinating woman named Swan, who, now I can't remember if she was born there, but she was raised there.
Yes, that's right. She is, Terminator is her hometown. I think she was born there, although I may not have said that. But she is one of the many sun worshippers, and also one of the many people on who live in Terminator who go out in spacesuits with little supply carts and actually walk, because the whole thing is happening at a walking pace.
Mm-hmm.
So you can walk around Mercury, and maybe it'll take you, well, it's 177 days from sunrise to sunrise. And so you could circle the planet in a walk of a few months, a hike where while you're asleep, your friends would have to be pulling you along on the sleeping cart or whatever, because you can't really stop unless you get a good head start on the dawn. And so their lives do revolve around the contemplation of the nearby sun. It's just one of the many places that humanity has occupied in the book, and people like it there. The Mercury is beautifully named in that it is entirely named after artists, composers, writers, and people of the arts. And that was an early decision when they got those first photographs back of the mercurial surface. And I think that they did a wonderful job. It's really evocative to look at the map of Mercury, see how, you know, you can be passing between Hesiod and Sibelius, or you can see that Van Gogh is a little dot in the side of Pushkin, and it goes on and on like that.
Well, in fact, your Mercury has become a repository for some of Earth's greatest treasures that you find in the place that coincides to the spot on the planet named after that person, that artist.
Yes, this is another old idea of mine, that Mercury becomes the art museum. And essentially, Earth is too volatile of an environment for the great artworks to really be preserved for centuries upon centuries upon centuries. So they get into a safer environment, which is the surface of Mercury, by being buried underground and in safe conditions. So if you really want to see an artist in their full glory, like a single artist museum, like the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam, then you go to Mercury, and there you can see the great works of the past all collected in one place.
We had to talk about Swan. When I first met her, I wasn't sure I liked her. Mm. And then I didn't like her at all.
Mm-hmm.
Now she's growing on me again. She's a fascinating character, and somebody who has, in a sense, helped to create this this amazing world of the future.
Yes, Swan, the original idea for this novel was a kind of a joke. I had a British reviewer, Adam Roberts, notice that I seemed to be overfond of the system of the humors, the Greek system of sanguine, choleric, melancholy, and phlegmatic.
Mm-hmm.
And I laughed at that because it's true. And so I thought I would double down. And as a joke, I was thinking I want to have a relationship between a mercurial character and a Saturnine character. It's somewhat astrological, also Greek. And the idea struck me funny because although that would be a very odd couple, all couples are odd. So it struck me as just an exaggeration of the norm. And it would be a way to discover how do couples get along at all when they're all odd couples.
And this is, you mentioned the other half of this couple, is this fellow, I don't know if I'll get his name right, Warham?
Yeah, Warham.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And he's the Saturnine, in fact, literally Saturnine.
Yes, yes. And so if you're going to, I mean, the joke, typical of my lame humor, was that the mercurial character would come from Mercury and the Saturnine character would come from Saturn, from one of the moons. But that immediately implied the whole civilization. I needed solar system-wide civilization, or else how would you have someone living on Mercury? How would you have somebody living in the Saturn system? And that, in discussion with my editor, who was a big help to me, said, well, we'll put it out 300 years, so there's time to do it, and then we'll, we can't just occupy Mercury and Saturn, but everything, including the asteroids. The asteroids are used as little worlds, like city-states, where you hollow them out.
And you call them, many of them are called terraria.
Yeah, they are like a terrarium that you would, as a kid, a miniature environment that is controlled, a work of art, in effect. It's landscape art, like Andy Goldsworthy. Essentially, I had to build the world so that my central story would have a proper context to live in. And so Swan is the essence of the mercurial character, very moody, very changeable. Also, she's followed all the fashions in brain augmentations and body augmentations.
She sure has. We won't even get into some of the things that she's internalized.
No, we better not. She is a wild woman, but she's part of a culture where everybody's trying these things out. And one of the funnest of them that we can discuss on a family program is that she has a quantum computer in the bone of her skull. A friend who was dealing with deafness and essentially has a small computer in his skull behind his ear, helping him to hear. It's really miracles of modern medicine. And I thought, well, with miniaturization and if we do get quantum computers at all, you could imagine having one simply resting not in your brain but right next to your brain and in your auditory system. So Swan is constantly dogged by a double, which is an artificial intelligence inside her that she herself has programmed. So it's kind of like the old puppets, the marionettes that you manipulate, and that she's talking to herself in a way, but not really, because this computer is really, as a quantum computer, has an enormous amount of computing power and some good algorithms. And so it becomes an open question whether this thing in her skull could pass a Turing test or not. Sort of seems like it can.
They talk about a little bit about that. I think that Pauline, her cube, says that depends on who's asking the questions in the Turing test.
Yes, that's right. Can you be a smart enough questioner to break the difference? And, you know, for years I thought artificial intelligence is just a big adding machine. It's a search engine. There's not going to be consciousness. There's not even going to be a good imitation of consciousness. I was flat out disbelieving it. But when I began to read more about quantum computers, and I was thinking about the distinction that I used to make between human brains and computers, was that human brains are not digital. They're not binary. And if you believe Roger Penrose in his theories that there are quantum entanglement effects going on at the smallest levels of our brain, and that was what made us superposed and kind of quantum creatures, so that we're not really digital computers with just a really big base. We're something different. Well, but if you had a quantum computer, then that makes it a moot point, because once again, you've got quantum effects. And so the distinction that Penrose was making that I was following between brains and computers begins to fall apart when you have a quantum computer.
I suspect, because there are nefarious doings in this tale, which in fact Swan has been recruited into trying to uncover. She has lost someone very dear to her who has something to do with all this stuff going on around the solar system. And it seems that, at least you're hinting at the point I'm at in the book, that these cubes, these quantum computers, have something to do with this central conflict or conspiracy in the book?
Yes, that's right. There is a mystery. The plot, as such, hinges on a mystery of who is attacking these little worlds. And, of course, every world in space is extremely vulnerable. You really only need to puncture them, and it's a deadly accident. So they're vulnerable, and you really need to have the entire world at peace. And that's hard to do, especially with Earth still messed up, as it is in this particular scenario. So my detectives are on the hunt for who and why someone is out there popping worlds like soap bubbles. And the cubes are clearly implicated, because the kind of calculations that have been necessary to do the sabotages are beyond classical computers' abilities. So they clearly have something to do with what's going on, and that makes it a very problematic mystery, because there are suggestions that the quantum computers are somewhat self-evolving and headed off into a society and world of their own that people don't have a view into. So I pursue that a little bit, which I do think is one of the coming problems. So, and I tried to pursue what I call the kitchen sink principle, which is that everything in the kitchen sink is thrown into this book so that it isn't a single-issue book.
Mm-hmm.
It's really about 300 years from now, when you look at the incredible technological powers that we're gaining every day, and you also contrast that against the stupendous environmental damage we're doing to Earth itself, you get such a mixed picture that what I wanted to do was to throw it all out there in one story and see if we could sort out the strands and see if it looked possible to have a high-tech and thriving civilization at the same time that Earth is so environmentally damaged. And I'm not convinced that it is possible, but it certainly is our current plan. So if the book lays it out and you read the book and you say, but wait, that couldn't happen, one has to take pause, because that's exactly what we're doing right now. So if you say what we're doing right now cannot possibly lead to a civilized result, then maybe we need to do something different.
Hmm.
But it certainly is a way to think about it, to throw it all out on the page at once.
That's Kim Stanley Robinson. We'll talk much more about his new novel, 2312, along with some of his other recent work. This is Planetary Radio.
I'm Robert Picardo. I traveled across the galaxy as the Doctor in Star Trek Voyager. Then I joined the Planetary Society to become part of the real adventure of space exploration. The Society fights for missions that unveil the secrets of the solar system. It searches for other intelligences in the universe, and it built the first solar sail. It also shares the wonder through this radio show, its website, and other exciting projects that reach around the globe. I'm proud to be part of this greatest of all voyages, and I hope you'll consider joining us.
You can learn more about the Planetary Society at our website, planetary.org/radio, or by calling 1-800-9-WORLDS. Planetary Radio listeners who aren't yet members can join and receive a Planetary Radio t-shirt. Our nearly 100,000 members receive the internationally acclaimed Planetary Report magazine. That's planetary.org/radio. The Planetary Society, exploring new worlds.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. My special guest this week is Nebula and Hugo-winning author Kim Stanley Robinson. His new and brilliant novel, 2312, will blow you away with its vision of a future 3 centuries from now that finds humanity occupying every corner of our solar system, even as Earth deals with the cumulative and terrible effects of global warming. They are not all there is to the book by any means, but ecological themes are very important in 2312.
Which is not surprising, since this is a Kim Stanley Robinson work. And yet they are, it's not, as you said, you cover a lot of ground in many issues, but they are interwoven beautifully.
Well, thank you. And it is a collage. The style of the novel comes from John Dos Passos and his USA trilogy, and he invented this collage method that's very powerful and very fun. So I did weave it all together. And what I postulated is that what we're doing right now implies almost the necessity of imagining an Earth that is heavily damaged, including significantly higher sea levels.
Mm.
So that's something that I've been pounding on ever since the Mars trilogy, as people might remember, where I had a kind of catastrophic single rise of sea level when the West Antarctic ice sheet comes off. Well, in this novel, it's simply a process of climate change and global warming causing more and more of the Earth's ice to melt, including the Greenland ice cap and the West Antarctic ice cap again. And in the book, 300 years from now, I have sea level being about 35 to 40 feet higher. That's radical, and yet not at all unlikely. Once the ice starts melting, it may get into a process of a positive feedback loop to the point that humanity simply won't be able to stop it, even if they want to. And they will surely want to, because 35 or 40 feet, essentially I have Manhattan as a kind of a Venice.
Exactly what I was going to refer to.
Yeah. But sea level's everywhere. I looked around the world, and of course it's like one of those coffee cups you can do this to. Most of Florida's underwater, and it goes on and on like that. I read somewhere that about a quarter of the world's population lives within 100 kilometers of a coastline. And so many people would be displaced. As someone calculated that this kind of sea level rise would be the equivalent of, say, 10,000 New Orleans after Katrina's. And we couldn't even handle one New Orleans after Katrina. So it's very suggestive that this would be disruptive in an extreme way. Now, at the same time, I have a high-functioning space civilization, and they are actually hoping to help Earth out of its troubles by the tail wagging the dog, by space helping in the ways that it can, which are limited, but nevertheless might be something that we do need in the real world. So again, I'm trying to explore that and see if all these things happening at once. Because the thing about the climate change and the global warming is that it's not going to be apocalypse. It's not going to be like we fall over a cliff and are instantly in Mad Max. It's more going to be localized damage. It's going to be increased insurance costs. Everything's going to cost more. Everything's going to get more dangerous. But science is going to go on. Technology is going to go on. And we're going to be coping with it. So it'll be this race between disaster or catastrophe, and a sustainable, decent civilization. And the two are kind of looking like the same thing, fighting in the same history for quite some long time before we come out in the clear or fall off.
Or not.
Yeah. But I have a lot of confidence that if you give it generation after generation after generation, each generation is going to think, well, this is normal, and we have to cope the best we can, and we're going to throw our technological expertise into the breach of the problem. And I do think that there's reason for hope, even though we're at a dark moment right now.
I can't let this conversation end without adding my praise to a couple of other books that I've absolutely loved. And of course, mixed into this is your Science and the Capital series, which if anybody wants a good view from the inside, because you were there, of how science works in Washington, or doesn't, it's a terrific series for that. But I tend toward the fantastic, and so, as I told you before we started recording, Years of Rice and Salt, an amazing view of an alternate present. I really was left on a higher plane, I think, after reading that. And then much more recently, a delightful time reading Galileo's Dream, which jumped back and forth between the life of this irascible, perhaps greatest genius of all time, apologies to Leonardo, and this future that he suddenly finds himself in, which is even beyond what you've depicted in 2312.
Yes, well, thank you for that. I'm very fond of both those books, and Science and the Capital coming between them was a mess and an experiment, and I still will speak for the middle volume. I think you can get what you need out of Science and the Capital by just going to the central volume of it, kind of the middle of the story, 50 degrees below, and you can catch what that one's about and then go forward and backward if you want. But with the Years of Rice and Salt, that's surely the book that will always mean the most to me. Mm. And then Galileo was such a joy. I really had a lot of fun. And also I did the classic science fiction things that I had avoided up until that point in my career. I did a time travel story, which of course is a naughty mess. you can't help getting in entangled in the paradoxes, and that's just the way time travel is. But that's part of the fun.
Yes.
Can you play that game? And I did. And then also a little bit of the alien as well in Galileo's Dream, a kind of a Star Maker type alien that is bigger or stranger than we can truly comprehend, like Solaris or Star Maker. And Galileo himself, what a character.
What a great character.
What a gift to the novelist.
Mm.
Because the more I read about him, the more I thought that what all I need to do is to properly present him, to be the usher that just gives you Galileo. I don't have to work him up. I don't have to tone him down. He himself is just a perfect gift to the novelist and a good person to get to know. So I tried to construct the story to reveal Galileo even more than a biography would, by making up some of his dialogue, by putting him in bizarre new situations and seeing how he would react. And I got pretty confident that I was dialed in and that Galileo was somehow speaking in these new situations. And so it could not have been more fun.
And what a delightful rascal. I tell people, read Galileo's Daughter, Davis O'Bell's terrific book, and then read Galileo's Dream.
Yes. And the Sobel book is very good. What Sobel did was to rescue Galileo's Daughter for the English reading public. Mm. And a Victorian woman, Mary Ellen Olney, did the same thing for the Victorians, but she had again been forgotten. She's never forgotten in Italy because her book is a minor classic there, her letters to her father. So, but what Sobel did was bring the daughter back into the story, and that brought in the whole human dimension, the home life. And so a lot of the biographies stay in the realm of his ideas, of his struggles with the church, and the home life is something that's in the background. But what Sobel gave to us was his home life. And then as a novelist, I could go on from there and try to cobble together a total picture. And it was an awful lot of fun.
Highly recommended. In fact, all of these works that we have talked about have been a delight to read. And it is a delight to speak to you once again, especially with this newest work, 2312, in front of us. I don't remember the publisher. Can you read that
Orbit.
Off the spine?
It's from Orbit. Orbit Books, yes.
Available right now.
Yes, in audio, ebook, and print.
And I'm reading the ebook version. So it's nice to see the cover there in front of me for a change. Stan, as I said, always a pleasure. I look forward to the next conversation.
Well, thank you, Matt. I'd be happy to come back, and I look forward to it, too.
Author Kim Stanley Robinson, during a visit to the Planetary Society a few days ago. Want to build your own terrarium inside an asteroid? Go to orbitbooks.net/2312. While you're there, you can read a great excerpt from 2312. We'll have that link at planetary.org/radio, of course, and I'll be right back with Bruce Betts.
Such a pleasure to be sitting across the table from Bruce Betts, right where I spoke to Stan Robinson, our guest this week, a little while ago. Hopefully people just heard that. Fascinating guy. Love his work.
Indeed. Fabulous.
So, the night sky. Would you happen to know anything about it?
Why, yes, sir, I would. You know, we've been previewing it, but things are coming. We did the solar eclipse. Now we've got a partial lunar eclipse, and that is coming up on June 3rd, 4th, so the night of June 3rd and over into the morning, for example, our time. It is a partial eclipse, but it still will be about 2 hours of partiality. And I don't think you call it partiality, but I do. I also say eclipses last 2 years long.
I want to see that two-year eclipse.
That would be awesome. So about a third of the moon will enter the umbral shadow, the dark part, the part we see easily. And that's the level of the partial eclipse, but still very cool looking. The partial eclipse will begin on the 4th, basically 10 o'clock UT. And so 3 o'clock for us Pacific Daylight Time people. Greatest eclipse occurs about an hour later, and end of eclipse occurs about an hour after that. So that's your partial eclipse. Check that out. That will be visible from most of Asia, Australia, the Pacific Ocean, and most of the Americas. Now, Venus transit is coming up just a couple days after that. Well, that will be on June 5th or 6th, depending on your time zone. So this is Venus crossing in front of the sun as seen from the Earth, something that will not happen again until 2117.
I think I'm going to buy that solar filter for my telescope.
Oh,
it's not
awesome.
Cheap. But I think I'm going to get it, because this really shouldn't be missed.
You should buy it and bring it here.
And just wear it.
And No. Use it for the solar eclipse, and then, like, get a big chain and hang it around your neck.
It'd be like a giant monocle that I could just wear on that chain and then lift up to my eye now and then.
And see nothing, because it would be so dark.
Yeah.
Venus would appear as a small dark disk moving across the sun. Don't stare at the sun, kids or adults. Do things properly.
But mama, that's where the fun is.
nice.
Thank
good
you.
Reference.
Thank
that
you.
Was good. But seriously, whether it's where the fun is or not, it's also where eye damage occurs. So either project it onto a wall, check out a feed over the internet, get a solar filter. There's lots and lots of stuff on the internet. And if you're going to try to order solar glasses, as I learned before the solar eclipse, you do it early.
This is taking so long, all this special stuff. You got to rush through everything.
This is special. I'm not done with the special stuff. It doesn't happen again until 2117. I'll be quick with the rest of it. Transit, best viewed from the Pacific Ocean. North America will be able to see the start of the transit before sunset, while Southern Asia, Northern Africa, and most of Europe will see the end of it. I'm still going. The first contact will occur at 2209 UT or 1509 here in the Pacific coast. And it goes for about 7 hours. The whole thing takes about 7 hours for Venus to rush across. No, wait, I'm sorry. I'm the one rushing. Venus takes about 7 years to go across. All right.
7 years, you said.
Did I do it again?
You did
it again. Man, I have got issues today. Ah, okay.
I've heard of the seven-year itch, but the seven-year transit?
That'd be cool, though. It'd be a lot less pressure to see it. You're like, oh, I missed it today. It was cloudy. Big deal. We'll see it tomorrow and next week and the week after. Speaking of weeks, well, I'll just... Mars, Saturn, still up in the evening sky. Venus dropping really fast, probably out of the view by the time you're hearing it because it has to meet up for that Venus transit. This week in space history, a quick nod to Abel and Baker, the first primates to survive spaceflight in 1959. We move on to random space fact. Eclipses. Christopher Columbus in 1504 in Jamaica actually had prediction tables with him and used a lunar eclipse to intimidate the natives into continuing giving them food. Like, my God is mad at you. They will eat. There will be a sign. So apparently this, you know, there's this reference in Mark Twain's Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Eclipse, solar eclipse.
Yeah.
Well, apparently Christopher Columbus actually pulled this shtick in 1504 on Jamaica, and it worked.
Another reason to celebrate his big day.
Well, you got to give him, it's clever.
It's very clever.
Creepy, but clever. Very clever. All right, we move on to the trivia contest. What is the value of the Hubble constant? Hubble constant, of course, connecting the distance of galaxies to their velocity. How'd we do?
I guess the Hubble constant is of great value. Actually.
Huge to understanding the evolution and fate of the universe.
Well, here's our winner, Ben Owens. Ben Owens of Greensboro, Victoria, Australia, past winner, who said, now, we got a whole range of numbers. In fact, this led David Kaplan to say, given the amount of variability in this, it should be called Hubble's non-constant, or not constant.
Well, we think the value is constant. It's the measurement that's having trouble, and we get better and better at it. But yes, there's still slop, which I told people. We just need something close to get the right answer.
Well, how's this? Ben said 72 kilometers per second per, is this megaparsec?
Megaparsec, yes.
Man, yeah, you should do this one in the random space fact voice. He said, interestingly, most sources acknowledge a range between 50 and 100. Given the extreme precision of some of the results, he said, I would have thought this is pretty big, but not so for cosmologists.
Well, that's true. It's only, even planetary scientists, factor two is close enough. But the cosmologists have narrowed it down a lot more than that. Mm-hmm. It's in the low 70s.
So he's a winner.
He's a winner.
All right, Ben, we're going to send you a Planetary Radio t-shirt. I just want to mention also Joel Tatham, who says that he was discussing this just the other day with his daughter, who was doing her entrance exams for the university, open and closed universe options, as well as the value of critical density. I've never had a conversation like this with my daughters.
I'm sorry.
Well, congratulations.
But they're wonderful. They're wonderful people.
Yes, they are. I wouldn't give them up for the world, but Joel, more power to you.
All right. Next trivia contest. What is the name of the scale commonly used to rate the visual appearance and brightness of the moon during total lunar eclipses? So this is a simplified scale. It's just a like 1 to 5 scale of how bright it is, how red it is, that kind of thing. What's the name of that scale? Go to planetary.org/radio, find out how to enter.
And you have until Monday, June 4th, Monday the 4th at 2 p.m. Pacific time to get us this answer and maybe win yourself a Planetary Radio t-shirt.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about how long you can stare at those multi-year eclipses. Only stare at the lunar ones, not the solar ones. Thank you and good night.
He's Bruce Betts, fighting to preserve our vision in every possible way. He joins us every week here for What's Up.
Another visit with Cassini Project scientist Linda Spilker. That's next week on Planetary Radio, which is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and made possible by a grant from the Kenneth T. and Eileen L. Norris Foundation and by the members of the Planetary Society. Clear skies.
A few months ago, the Nobel Prize in Physics was awarded to two teams of astronomers for a discovery that has been hailed as one of the most important astronomical observations ever. And today, after briefly describing what they found, I'm going to tell you about a highly controversial framework for explaining their discovery, namely the possibility that way beyond the Earth, the Milky Way, and other distant galaxies, we may find that our universe is not the only universe, but is instead part of a vast complex of universes that we call the multiverse. Now, the idea of a multiverse is a strange one. I mean, most of us were raised to believe that the word universe means everything. And I say most of us with forethought, as my four-year-old daughter has heard me speak of these ideas since she was born. And last year, I was holding her and I said, "Sophia, I love you more than anything in the universe." And she turned to me and said, "Daddy, universe or multiverse?" But barring such an anomalous upbringing, it is strange to imagine other realms separate from ours, most with fundamentally different features, that would rightly be called universes of their own. And yet, speculative though the idea surely is, I aim to convince you that there's reason for taking it seriously, as it just might be right. I'm going to tell the story of the multiverse in three parts. In part one, I'm going to describe those Nobel Prize-winning results and highlight a profound mystery which those results revealed. In part two, I'll offer a solution to that mystery. It's based on an approach called string theory, and that's where the idea of the multiverse will come into the story. Finally, in part three, I'm going to describe a cosmological theory called inflation, which will pull all the pieces of the story together. Okay, part one starts back in 1929 when the great astronomer Edwin Hubble realized that the distant galaxies were all rushing away from us, establishing that space itself is stretching, it's expanding. Now, this was revolutionary. The prevailing wisdom was that on the largest of scales, the universe was static. But even so, there was one thing that everyone was certain of. The expansion must be slowing down. That is, much as the gravitational pull of the Earth slows the ascent of an apple tossed upward, the gravitational pull of each galaxy on every other must be slowing the expansion of space. Now let's fast forward to the 1990s, when those two teams of astronomers I mentioned at the outset were inspired by this reasoning to measure the rate at which the expansion has been slowing. And they did this by painstaking observations of numerous distant galaxies, allowing them to chart how the expansion rate has changed over time. Here's the surprise. They found that the expansion is not slowing down. Instead, they found that it's speeding up, going faster and faster. That's like tossing an apple upward, and it goes up faster and faster. Now, if you saw an apple do that, you'd want to know why. What's pushing on it? Similarly, the astronomers' results are surely well-deserving of the Nobel Prize, but they raised an analogous question. What force is driving all galaxies to rush away from every other at an ever-quickening speed? Well, the most promising answer comes from an old idea of Einstein's. You see, we are all used to gravity being a force that does one thing, pulls objects together. But in Einstein's theory of gravity, his general theory of relativity, gravity can also push things apart. How? Well, according to Einstein's math, if space is uniformly filled with an invisible energy, sort of like a uniform invisible mist, then the gravity generated by that mist would be repulsive. Repulsive gravity, which is just what we need to explain the observations, because the repulsive gravity of an invisible energy in space, we now call it dark energy, but I've made it smoky white here so you can see it. Its repulsive gravity would cause each galaxy to push against every other, driving the expansion to speed up, not slow down. And this explanation represents great progress. But I promise you a mystery here in part one. Here it is. When the astronomers worked out how much of this dark energy must be infusing space to account for the cosmic speed-up, Look at what they found. This number is small. Expressed in the relevant units, it is spectacularly small. And the mystery is to explain this peculiar number. We want this number to emerge from the laws of physics, but so far no one has found a way to do that. Now, you might wonder, should you care? Maybe explaining this number is just a technical issue, a technical detail of interest to experts, but of no relevance to anybody else. Well, it surely is a technical detail, but some details really matter. Some details provide windows into uncharted realms of reality, and this peculiar number may be doing just that, as the only approach that so far made headway to explain it invokes the possibility of other universes, an idea that naturally emerges from string theory, which takes me to part two, string theory. So hold the mystery of the dark energy in the back of your mind as I now go on to tell you three key things about string theory. First off, what is it? Well, it's an approach to realize Einstein's dream of a unified theory of physics, a single overarching framework that would be able to describe all the forces at work in the universe. And the central idea of string theory is quite straightforward. It says that if you examine any piece of matter ever more finely, at first you'll find molecules, and then you'll find atoms and subatomic particles. But the theory says that if you could probe smaller, much smaller than we can with existing technology, you'd find something else inside these particles. A little tiny vibrating filament of energy, a little tiny vibrating string. And just like the strings on a violin, they can vibrate in different patterns, producing different musical notes. These little fundamental strings, when they vibrate in different patterns, they produce different kinds of particles. So electrons, quarks, neutrinos, photons, all other particles would be united into a single framework, as they would all arise from vibrating strings. It's a compelling picture, a kind of cosmic symphony, where all the richness that we see in the world around us emerges from the music that these little tiny strings can play. But there's a cost to this elegant unification, because years of research have shown that the math of string theory doesn't quite work. It has internal inconsistencies unless we allow for something wholly unfamiliar: extra dimensions of space. That is, we all know about the usual three dimensions of space, and you can think about those as height, width, and depth. But string theory says that on fantastically small scales, there are additional dimensions crumpled to a tiny size, so small that we have not detected them. But even though the dimensions are hidden, they would have an impact on things that we can observe, because the shape of the extra dimensions constrains how the strings can vibrate. And in string theory, vibration determines everything. So particle masses, the strengths of forces, and most importantly, the amount of dark energy would be determined by the shape of the extra dimensions. So if we knew the shape of the extra dimensions, we should be able to calculate these features, calculate the amount of dark energy. The challenge is, we don't know the shape of the extra dimensions. All we have is a list of candidate shapes allowed by the math. Now, when these ideas were first developed, there were only about five different candidate shapes, so you could imagine analyzing them one by one to determine if any yield the physical features we observe. But over time, the list grew as researchers found other candidate shapes. From five, the number grew into the hundreds and then the thousands, a large but still manageable collection to analyze, since, after all, graduate students need something to do. But then the list continued to grow into the millions and the billions, until today, the list of candidate shapes has soared to about 10 to the 500. So, what to do? Well, some researchers lost heart, concluding that with so many candidate shapes for the extra dimensions, each giving rise to different physical features, string theory would never make definitive, testable predictions. But others turned this issue on its head, taking us to the possibility of a multiverse. Here's the idea. Maybe each of these shapes is on an equal footing with every other. Each is as real as every other in the sense that there are many universes, each with a different shape for the extra dimensions. And this radical proposal has a profound impact on this mystery, the amount of dark energy revealed by the Nobel Prize-winning results, because you see, if there are other universes, and if those universes each have, say, a different shape for the extra dimensions, then the physical features of each universe will be different, and in particular, the amount of dark energy in each universe will be different, which means that the mystery of explaining the amount of dark energy we've now measured would take on a wholly different character. In this context, the laws of physics can't explain one number for the dark energy because there isn't just one number. There are many numbers, which means we have been asking the wrong question. Instead, the right question to ask is, why do we humans find ourselves in a universe with a particular amount of dark energy we've measured instead of any of the other possibilities that are out there? And that's a question on which we can make headway, because those universes that have much more dark energy than ours, whenever matter tries to clump into galaxies, the repulsive push of the dark energy is so strong that it blows the clump apart and galaxies don't form. And in those universes that have much less dark energy, well, they collapse back on themselves so quickly that again, galaxies don't form. And without galaxies, there are no stars, no planets, and no chance for our form of life to exist in those other universes. So we find ourselves in a universe with a particular amount of dark energy we've measured simply because our universe has conditions hospitable to our form of life. And that would be that. Mystery solved, multiverse found. Now, some find this explanation unsatisfying. We're used to physics giving us definitive explanations for the features we observe. But the point is, if the feature you're observing can and does take on a wide variety of different values across the wider landscape of reality, then seeking one explanation for a particular value is simply misguided. An early example comes from the great astronomer Johannes Kepler, who was obsessed with understanding a different number, why the sun is 93 million miles away from the Earth. And he worked for decades trying to explain this number, but he never succeeded, and we know why. Kepler was asking the wrong question. We now know that there are many planets at a wide variety of different distances from their host star, so hoping that the laws of physics will explain one particular number, 93 million miles, well, that is simply wrong-headed. Instead, the right question to ask is, why do we humans find ourselves on a planet at this particular distance instead of any of the other possibilities? And again, that's a question we can answer. Those planets which are much closer to a star like the sun would be so hot that our form of life wouldn't exist. And those planets that are much farther away from the star, well, they're so cold that, again, our form of life would not take hold. So we find ourselves on a planet at this particular distance simply because it yields conditions vital to our form of life. And when it comes to planets and their distances, this clearly is the right kind of reasoning. The point is, when it comes to universes and the dark energy that they contain, it may also be the right kind of reasoning. One key difference, of course, is we know that there are other planets out there, but so far I've only speculated on the possibility that there might be other universes. So to pull it all together, we need a mechanism that can actually generate other universes. And that takes me to my final part, part three. Because such a mechanism has been found by cosmologists trying to understand the Big Bang. You see, when we speak of the Big Bang, we often have an image of a kind of cosmic explosion that created our universe and set space rushing outward. But there's a little secret. The Big Bang leaves out something pretty important, the bang. It tells us how the universe evolved after the bang, but gives us no insight into what would have powered the bang itself. And this gap was finally filled by an enhanced version of the Big Bang Theory. It's called inflationary cosmology, which identified a particular kind of fuel that would naturally generate an outward rush of space. The fuel is based on something called a quantum field, but the only detail that matters for us is that this fuel proves to be so efficient that it's virtually impossible to use it all up, which means in the inflationary theory, the Big Bang giving rise to our universe is likely not a one-time event. Instead, the fuel not only generates our Big Bang, but it would also generate countless other Big Bangs, each giving rise to its own separate universe, with our universe becoming but one bubble in a grand cosmic bubble bath of universes. And now, if we meld this with string theory, here's the picture we're led to. Each of these universes has extra dimensions. The extra dimensions take on a wide variety of different shapes. The different shapes yield different physical features. And we find ourselves in one universe instead of another, simply because it's only in our universe that observations reveal the horizon. Thank you very much.
Brian, thank you. The range of ideas you've just spoken about are dizzying, exhilarating, incredible. How do you think of where cosmology is now in a sort of historical side? Are we in the middle of something unusual historically, in your opinion?
Well, it's hard to say. When we learn that astronomers of the far future may not have enough information to figure things out, the natural question is, maybe we're already in that position, and certain deep critical features of the universe already have escaped our ability to understand because of how cosmology evolves. So from that perspective, maybe we will always be asking questions and never be able to fully answer them. On the other hand, we now can understand how old the universe is. We can understand how to understand the data from the microwave background radiation that was set down 13.72 billion years ago, and yet we can do calculations today to predict how it will look, and it matches. Holy cow, that's just amazing. So on the one hand, it's just incredible where we've gotten, but who knows what sort of blocks we may find in the future.
You're going to be around for the next few days. Maybe some of these conversations can continue. Thank you.
My pleasure.
So
thank
much.
You.
Thank you, Brian.
Once again, the Dearborn Farmers and Artisans Market returns to bring in support of local farmers and entrepreneurs right to the heart of Dearborn. Beginning May the 25th, over 30 Michigan vendors will be selling some of the finest seasonal products, from produce goods and flowers to garden art and woodworkings. This will also mark additional times for the market. Tuesday evenings, June 19th, July 17th, and August the 21st. The Dearborn Farmers and Artisans Market will be open every Friday starting May the 25th from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. and is located on West Michigan Avenue between Mason and Howard. For more information about the market, including special Tuesday hours, check out DearbornFarmersArtisansMarket.com.
The odds of becoming a signed artist and having 3 number one albums? 1 in 100 million. The odds of going on to win 6 Grammy Awards? 1 in 1.4 million. The odds of this performer having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. I'm Toni Braxton, and I encourage you to learn the signs of autism at AutismSpeaks.org. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Lee.